Hello from Patricia Glynn and Storycatcher. Simple stories, simply told. This is Potpourri, a monthly selection of short stories from the people of Southern Africa. I've collected them on the road. They're universal, they're everyday, and they're yours. And so we come to the end of our first season of Storycatcher. I'd hoped it would be in a month's time after we'd brought you more stories from the Waterberg, but Alexandra has decided otherwise. Her whole electrical system is doing flick-flacks. I've had to find alternative means of getting water into her tanks because the customary one isn't functioning, and the geyser has said no to my dreams of a hot shower. The fates have decided, and as if in congruence, there's a huge wind outside and I can't get the awning packed away before the predicted rain arrives. So, as soon as we can, we're out of here. And it's so ironic that we'd be skedaddling from a place that is so wondrous and welcoming. It becomes clear soon after you arrive that there's a reason why the Waterberg has been and is being restored to what it was like when the sand bushmen were doing their Sistine paintings on the rocky ceilings of the caves around here. From peak after peak and pinnacle after pinnacle, you are graced with the sight of verdant bush, cliffs and kranzes, sandy roads, and the odd, really the odd, dwelling. And there live people who are restoring this piece of heaven, hectare by hectare. They range from academic experts and writers to those who've walked these hills for generations and acquired their deep knowledge through their feet, their eyes and ears. I have learned just a little about the wondrous Waterberg through those I've chatted to and interviewed, and I'm deeply grateful to them, as I am to those who welcomed me into their homes and onto their busy to-do lists. More on those kind folk at the end of the show. We begin our potpourri with someone who is widely recognized as having an unparalleled depth of understanding about the creatures and systems in this area. Warwick Tarberton has been visiting the Waterberg since he was a schoolboy, poking his inquisitive nose under rocks and bushes and into nests and flowers. After several decades of doing so alone, he was joined by his wife, Michelle, who matches his enthusiasm for all things wild and wonderful. But I didn't want to interview them. Here's the four-line synopsis I was given about them. Warwick is a polymath with degrees in geology and zoology, a PhD in dragonflies. He's a prominent ornithologist and co-author of many bird books. Michelle has co-authored with him and others books on birds, dragonflies, wildflowers, and trees. They started and run the Waterberg BioQuest website, a biodiversity database. Well, they sounded way too clever for little old me. And they are, of course, but they're the most down-to-earth people and they wear their knowledge very lightly, as you'll hear. Michelle declined to be interviewed, as they say on the news channels, but I asked Warwick first about how the Waterberg differs from what he knew as a boy.
It's changed completely because in those days it was all cattle farms. Quite a lot of the roads didn't even have farm fences on their side. So you could drive anywhere if you saw something of interest in the veld. You could just climb over a fence and go in. And big places like Lephalala, which we both independently went to long ago, they had four sort of bush camps there. And then I think Lephalala sort of opened the door to the sort of game farming as being an alternate enterprise to cattle. And of course, you know, where you had water like along the rivers and more fertile soils, there was tobacco farming and other kind of farming. So the crop farming has all continued, but everywhere where there was cattle virtually has been transformed into game farming. And a lot of those places like Lephalala have become, you know, fenced and enclosed, very exclusive. I mean, ordinary people can't go there, you know, you've got to have the bucks. So that's become more and more the case. I mean, of course, there's still lots and lots of nice places in the Waterberg where you can go and walk around. But everywhere, you can't drive on a public road without having game farms, fences on both sides of it. And that is, to me, a massive transformation. You, wherever you drive, you feel you're fenced in. So the whole of the Waterberg is just one enclosure after the other. And some of them are big enclosures, 50,000 hectares. Some of them are 100 hectares, but they're all enclosures. And so it's a profound change. The trees and the flowers and everything are unchanged, but anything that moves around has changed.
It was the bucks that drove this transformation, but there has been very deliberate attention paid to some very precious areas, ecologically precious areas.
Yeah, oh, for sure. I think the establishment of the Murray-Keeley Park was one of those, you know, that's a national park. And its main feature is its scenery, because it's very rugged country. But biologically, or in terms of fauna and flora, the cliffs there are home to one of the biggest colonies of Cape vultures. A quarter of the world's population of Cape vultures breed there. So that, from my perspective, is the biggest contribution Murray-Keeley has. They've expanded it, and so they've got a section of Murray-Keeley which is in flat country, which they've developed with campsites and so on. But the rugged part of it, most of it is inaccessible. There are a couple of roads, and there's a road up to the summit. I don't know if you've been up there.
Mm-mm.
You go up to the highest point in the Waterberg there, and there you're in the ultimate part of the Waterberg, because you're in a spectacular landscape. You've got these 200-metre cliffs dropping away on this side, a supreme valley that you've driven up, a hairy road, and so on to get up there. So Murray-Keeley is one of those prime spots.
It's one of the things about this spectacular place is that you don't know which is your favourite view until you see the next one. But the damage to this place was done initially, was it not, by early hunters?
I'm not sure about that. Going back to the original map of the Waterberg, it stands as a sandstone island, a bit raised like a saucer, as we said, but around it are all these surrounding plains, which in terms of soil quality are much richer. The Springbok Flats, which has been ploughed out, there's virtually no natural vegetation left there, are on super rich soils for agriculture. Even the Limpopo Valley, which surrounds the Waterberg on the other sides, are much better soils. And this, the Waterberg is just the sandstone formation that weathers down to coarse sand with no clay in it, no nutrients in it. And if you want to grow a crop there, you've got to feed the crop everything that will grow the plant. And that doesn't only apply to plants, it applies to everything in the system. The grazing, the stocking rate is much lower. You know, it would be 12 hectares for one animal, compared to on the Springbok Flats, it might have been 5 hectares for an animal. So the carrying capacity of the Waterberg as a whole is very low. So when you say hunters killed it, I wonder how much of a hunting area it was. It would have had game, of course, and elephants and so on in the valleys and so on, but the carrying capacity of the game would have been a fraction of, say, what the Springbok Flats was once upon a time. And they talk about these herds of springbok that once migrated there.
But in the 1800s, for instance, I mean, were these wagons not leaving the Waterberg just filled with ivory and skins?
Well, they might have come from other areas, the Limpopo Valley and so on. Yeah, I mean, you can understand how the coloured game industry started, because apart from the big places like Lapalala and so on, a lot of other people rely on hunting for an income. And that hunting industry, you know, is a high-value thing, and one hunter pays so much money and so on. And I think it probably started in the 70s, this development of these coloured strains to provide special trophies for hunters.
So I've seen black impala.
Mm.
And I think I passed a little herd of very weird-looking wildebeest.
Yeah. And the wildebeest was probably the forerunner of it. And there's a...
They're tan-coloured.
They call it golden wildebeest. And they started breeding them in mass, hundreds of them, and selling them. And they were selling for huge amounts of money because they were these prime animals, golden. And there was this mystique about them, and the original ones were the last relic population in Botswana, sort of thing. This is all hearsay. Then they started breeding the different impala, and they started breeding different coloured springbok. And those could be bred in little camps and fed and bred like domestic animals and then put out and so on. And that spawned more and more people taking them in, and I think quite a lot of people got burnt when the whole thing eventually collapsed, because it has all collapsed. But there were times when there were very high value animals, and in the course of breeding all those animals, of course they didn't want any predators around, so there was a drive to get rid of any predators, whether they were eagles or jackals or whatever else, leopards. And that market has pretty well collapsed, I guess.
But the general hunting market hasn't.
But the general hunting market hasn't.
So what you're suggesting, or Jack's saying, is that to casual observers like me who visit the area and who think, oh, how wonderful it's been restored, it's not really, because there are fences that are preventing animals from moving, and the entire system is false.
Well, within the Waterberg, you've got all these different angles going on. There's the Welgevonden, Lapulala, Marakeli level, and there's several others. Some Arab investors have also got properties of 30, 40,000 hectares. And they are trying to establish a sort of original megafauna in the Waterberg, like Kruger Park. But it doesn't really match Kruger Park because it's not on the same scale. And, of course, you have the soil issue that I've talked about, which the Kruger Park doesn't have. The Kruger Park's on pretty rich basaltic soils. But then in amongst it, you've got other people wanting to make a living. You know, they might have inherited Opa's farm or something like that. How do you do it? You open it to game, so you breed the game that could be hunted. And the drive now has gone away from coloured game to breeding high-value animals like sable. Sable are being bred everywhere here, and now more recently buffalo are being bred everywhere because they bring in high-value hunters. And lots of buffalo, lots of
disease
properties
free.
Are breeding. Yeah, they're
disease-free. Disease-free.
Yeah. And they're properties there that are now exclusively breeding buffalo for the hunting market.
The other thing is, when you stand on a hill in the Waterberg and you look down, it looks so verdant. It looks so lush, and the bushes are... You can't see between the bush.
Well, you know, I think that when we did the tree book, we realised more and more the prime asset that the Waterberg has above everything else. You can put animals, elephants or anything, lions, anywhere, and as long as you provide them with a home there and some food and water and so on, you can have them anywhere. But the Waterberg, to us, prime kind of asset is its trees. And I mean, we weren't tree people, and we knew trees and so on until we tackled the tree book. And the tree book came about because there were others involved in it and so on.
Let me just say, it's 400 pages of exquisite study and photographs and information. It really is a triumph. So well done.
But you those trees are there forever, and they're everywhere there. And you know, when you look across the Waterberg, you might see this lovely landscape, and if you look more closely, you can see, oh, there's a coppice of Combretum apiculatum. It must be more rocky there. Or look at the size of those buccinotes. The soils must be deeper there. Or look at that red balloon there growing against the crowns. And there's all these 150,000 subtleties to the Waterberg that our books were trying to demonstrate, that you can go there without a gun and without a binoculars and so on, and you can get on your hands and knees and you can see wonderful stuff everywhere, and you can look across this landscape and think, oh, you know, what a nice scene it is. But you can go into it deeper and see how all these different tree species are fitting into the environment in different ways. There's all these little subtleties that escape the buffalo hunters and and even the hikers and bicycle people, you know.
Oh, yes, there's so, lots of so, you know, there's the Waterberg as fast as stuff, possible. You know. I see lots of indications of that. Mm. You enthused about the trees, but yours and your wife's, Michelle's, expertise. Well, you've got your experts in so much, it's breathtaking. One of the things you're passionate about is birds. So is the Waterberg renowned for birds in a certain way?
It doesn't match the best areas in South Africa. You know, if you want to see diversity, you go to Zululand. If you want to see endemics, you go to the Highveld or the Fynbos. The Waterberg is savanna, but it's, I've got a species list of 450, which is very impressive. It doesn't match the Kruger Park, which has got a species list of 550. There's nothing in the Waterberg that's not in the Kruger Park, simply because, well, various reasons for that. But the Waterberg, to see a diversity of species, you've got to go to a lot of different habitats. You've got to do the Palala River, you've got to do the mountains, you've got to do the Kranzes, you've got to go up to the top of Marikeli.
Oh, this is all such a pill.
And
poor old birders.
And so I don't think the Waterberg is a hot spot for birding.
What about the bees and the butterflies and the insects?
Everything else,
and
the, yeah.
I mean, there are species of moths that I wouldn't miss, frankly. They dive bomb, they're like squadrons that come in, and they're persistent. Yeah. They're so damn persistent you can't read a book because they get between your eyebrows and your glasses, which I think is damn cheeky. Yeah. So it seems to me that there's a huge plethora of moths and butterflies.
On the butterflies, there's 220 species, but only two of them are confined to the Waterberg. Moths, I can't talk about moths. There's a 500 species of spiders, thanks to surveys done by the spider expert in South Africa, and some of those are endemic. There's a big baboon spider that's only found in the Waterberg.
Black legs and yellowish body? No? I've seen one of those hanging in the pathway, waiting for people like me. Oh, the golden orb, yes.
That's the golden orb.
No, they truly, I'm afraid, can go, in my opinion. And few will miss them, to my mind, especially as you've got about 1,000 species of wildflowers to amuse you in the Waterberg, of which 100 are endemic. You've got 220 butterflies and, as you heard, about 450 kinds of birds. There are about 300 species of trees here. And I mentioned the tree book which Warwick Tarpeyton and his wife Michelle have produced. It's called Trees and Shrubs of the Waterberg, and it is quite the best tree book I've come across. And I have quite a good library of them. They've also produced a gorgeous book on the wildflowers and field guides to birds, dragonflies and damselflies. No grass growing under those 4 feet, I can tell you. Have a look at their Waterberg BioQuest website if you're heading up here. It's a collaborative enterprise with people who are fellow experts and enthusiasts in things to do with the Waterberg. There are wonderful maps of the area too, lists of places to stay, photographs of the most spectacular scenery, and even book recommendations. You no doubt know by now, and you certainly will if you've listened to our Inspirations feature this month, that Clive Walker and his partner Dale Parker founded the magical kingdom of Lapalala here in the Waterberg. It's a place which is as renowned for its wilderness school as it is for its natural beauty, and it now has its own biodiversity centre.
That is curated by an award-winning ichthyologist and ornithologist by the name of Bronwyn Marie. But we're going to talk about an earlier time in her life when she was on something called the Albatross Task Force. It's designed to reduce seabird bycatch on our trawlers. And to do that, Bronwyn and her colleagues went to sea on the trawlers and had the grisly duty of recording the numbers of birds that surrounded the vessels and got caught in the lines and nets. There were other aspects to the job which were pretty grisly too, like the smells and the sounds in the fishermen's living quarters.
On the vessel, it's everything from fish guts to oil and petrol and fumes from that to the cooking that's going on in the kitchen. So it's a huge, big mix of smells.
And in the sound department, I think of guys swearing like, well, sailors.
Yes.
And then saying, oh, sorry, sorry.
That's exactly it. So, yeah. So when they, obviously without the woman, they're a lot more free to talk and do what they want to do. But when they realize you're on board, then it is, oh, I'm sorry, I'm sorry. But they soon settle down. And I think it's actually quite a novelty for them to have a female guest on board.
Yeah, I'm sure it changes the whole dynamic.
Completely, completely. I'll always remember, I think it's 7 o'clock, that the soapies used to come on SABC and all the gentlemen were in the mess room, the dining hall, basically, to come and watch these soapies. And that was always such a surprise to me because you think of these big, strong men and here they're all coming for the soapies.
Sievendalane.
Exactly, it was Sievendalane. Yes.
A great compliment to Sievendalane, actually.
It was always Sievendalane and the WWE wrestling. That were the two big things.
What a contrast, hey?
Yeah.
What a contrast.
Yeah.
So these were chaps from the Cape, yeah?
Yeah, I'd probably say 90% Cape with some imports from, say, the Eastern Cape.
So a trip to sea is only a day?
No. So it depends on which type of vessel, the size of the vessel, how much fish it can hold, but anywhere between 3 days and maybe 2 to 3 weeks for some of the longline fisheries.
Okay, so they're given an audition, so to speak. They're taken out and tested on their physical strength and their sea legs. Were you given a test as well?
No, not really. I mean, I did get horribly seasick, so I had to figure that out myself. I just went and I did enjoy it. There were moments I didn't enjoy it, and you miss home, and the sea is very bad, and you can't sleep, and all of that. But, yeah.
And the count that you were doing, is that depressing, the bird count?
No. So to understand a little bit there, obviously, like you have on land, you've got areas where you have high numbers of different species. The same happens in the ocean. So you'll have periods where you don't see any birds, and it's not necessarily because there are no birds. It's just because there's no food there. It's not a very diverse area. But then you get other areas where you'll see lots of different types of birds, lots of numbers. And particularly with seabirds, some of your bigger seabirds require quite heavy winds because an albatross, you can imagine trying to take off from the ocean, it needs to have an uplift to come up. So you won't really find them flying around in areas where there's not a lot of wind. They'll just be sitting on the ocean if they are there.
Okay. And they mob the boats, don't they?
Yes, it's amazing. So as soon as, so just talking in terms of the trawlers, that's where most of my experience is. So when they bring the net up and they start winding in the winches, it makes quite a lot of noise. So when they're pulling up the net, the birds can hear it from very far away. And then they can obviously, they've got a very good sense of smell, so they can smell the fish as it's coming up. So as soon as that happens, the birds just start coming in. And then obviously birds from further away can also see the other birds flying around the vessel, and before you know it, you've got hundreds of birds behind these trawlers.
And is that the point where they are trapped in the nets, or is it when the nets are down?
So there's two ways within a trawler that the birds can get caught. So the first one is, yes, as the net comes up and as it's on the surface and the birds can see the fish, they dive into the net. Generally, only certain species will get caught like that. But in most cases, because it's as it's on the surface and as it's coming onto the vessel, we can get those birds out alive. So we did a lot of work with the fishermen to handle these birds and release them off the vessel. But the majority of birds, it's when the net is going down, it's being set into the ocean. The cables of the net are going very fast in the water. And at the same time that they're setting the net down is when they're busy processing the fish from the net before. So all your guts and heads and juicy bits that the birds want are now floating very close to the surface behind the boat. So the birds are diving for that, but accidentally get their wings hooked around the cables. And because the cables are moving so fast down, they get dragged underwater. And with that pressure, they can't get up. And that's generally how they're caught. And that's why in many cases, unless you're sitting watching it, you'll never know that that many birds are going down.
You're sitting there counting it.
Correct.
As a scientist.
Yes, yes.
How deeply distressing that must be.
Yes. Unless you've seen it, you can't really picture it. And like anything, certain vessels will be worse than others.
What's that? Because they care more or less?
It's partly to do with, yeah, whether, as I said, it's quite hierarchical. So whether the captain puts the right measures in place, maybe sets more at nighttime, less so for trawl fisheries. And also just sometimes the makeup of the vessel, its size, for example, or how far away the cables are going into the water can make an impact. Also, as I mentioned earlier, there are areas where you have more birds in general. So if you're fishing in those areas, you need to be a lot more careful. So that's also just a temporal variation.
So what do they do? Do they stop the rollout of the net?
No. So with a trawl fishery, what they're mainly using is a device called a torii line, which torii is the Japanese word for bird, also known as a bird scaring line. So it acts a bit like a scarecrow in your fields, your agricultural fields. But it's a long rope with these colorful streamers that hang down, and they are set on the outside of the cables that are going underwater, and it stops the bird getting access to that cable. So they can still feed from the discards coming off the boat, but it'll be further away and out of what we call the danger area. So that is the main thing that we do in the trawl fishery to prevent seabird bycatch.
There's also, is there not a modification to the hooks? Which has happened.
Yeah, so the long line fishing is a completely different story. It's much more complicated. So it's also when the lines are being set with these multiple hooks and it's going down. Each hook obviously has a piece of fish or squid or something to attract. It's a much newer design. It's called a hook pod. And it's essentially a capsule that you put over the barb of the hook that the birds can't. Birds and turtles and sharks and all of that, as it's going down, they can't get hooked. And at a certain depth, which you preset, there's a pressure release system that opens up this hook or this pod to release the hook down into the water. So you can still catch your fish, but on the way down, you haven't caught all the bycatch. And it's reusable. So when they bring the line back up again, they just close it again and it's ready to be loaded with the next hook for the next line to be set.
So I believe that you've reduced the bycatch by something like 99%.
Yes. So again, depending on what fishery you're speaking about. So within the trawl fishery, which is where I did most of my work, so the South African trawl fishery, which catches hake, we've managed to reduce bycatch of birds by 99%. So that's all birds, all seabirds that were being caught. And then albatrosses by 95%. So yeah, as long as the measures are in place and the fisheries continue to stick to the regulations, then we have these massive reductions in the number of birds that are caught.
There's a lot of policing now of what goes on these boats for the size of the catch, the way of the catch, and sustainability, blah, blah. Did the lines ever get blurred? Lines. off. Were the lines ever blurred between you as a scientist, an observer, and you as a policewoman? Regarded like that?
Yes, I think for the first time you engage on a particular vessel, there's always that superstition or that worry of what you are doing and what you're looking at. And it takes time to build that relationship. So even when you're not collecting your data out on the deck, you spend time talking to the fishermen, getting to know them as people, they get to know you, getting to explain that it's not just about the policing and the the collection of data. It's trying to explain the bigger picture. And an example that I can use here is one of our captains on one of our trawlers. After spending time with him and explaining, you know, how many of these seabirds there are, the size of their wings, and just a little bit more about their biology, he eventually started to take photographs. He bought himself a camera and he started to take photographs, and he ended up being someone who reported a lot of rare birds that were in our waters. And then he started to grow his photography and started taking pictures of, you know, vessels or whales. And it just opened his eyes to the bigger picture, as opposed to when our net comes up, there's lots of birds, there's nothing to worry about. Now he actually understood the bigger picture and that everything's connected to each other. And in terms of the blurring of the lines, so there's obviously when you're out at sea, you're going to see things that shouldn't be happening. And you've got to weigh up how you handle that, whether you go straight to authorities or whether you speak to the captain or you speak to the managers on shore. It's a very fine line, because they, at the time when I was going on these vessels, it was voluntarily that they were taking us on board. It wasn't a regulation that we had to be on there to monitor the birds. And so you had to be careful of ruining that relationship with the fishermen and the managers while you're trying to get information from them. So that was always a balancing act.
Have you seen any really bad accidents?
Luckily not. I have never been in a bad accident. They're also exceptionally good on safety at these vessels. Every single trip, you're either doing a fire drill or a lifeboat drill. So you all know exactly what you're doing, how you're doing, where you're going. And generally, it's at 3 o'clock in the morning when you're half asleep. of course.
That's the point.
And yeah, I mean, another incredible thing that I had never thought about until I'd been out at sea is you might be fast asleep, and these vessels are obviously very noisy. So you're hearing the engine all the time. You're hearing the guys working. It's a 24-hour working ship. And if the power suddenly cuts on the vessel and it goes dead quiet, you have never heard silence like that ever. It's unbelievable.
And that's an alarm call. You are up.
You're straight awake. Oh. I mean, it doesn't matter. You've got that lovely rocking motion to put you to sleep, but you can, when there's no sound whatsoever, it's quite eerie.
Eerie. In the process of doing this, you must have, forgive me my non-scientific expression, you must have fallen in love with birds. Now, does everybody fall in love with the albatross, or did you fall in love with other birds?
I think it's a bit of both. So I think when you see an albatross and the absolute size and majesticness, I mean, their wingspans are anywhere between from tip to tip, 2 meters to 3.5 meters. So you're talking about an exceptionally large bird. And when you're sitting at the back of the fishing vessel and they're coming past at eye level, they're just incredibly graceful. But there are equally some of the smaller birds, which are just as beautiful. And I think part of the attraction with seabirds is many people will never get to see them, because these seabirds we're talking about now, your petrels, your albatrosses, your shearwaters, they don't really come close to the coast. They'll come close to the coast in very windy conditions where you might be able to use binoculars or a scope to see them, but generally they're far offshore. I wouldn't say it's just albatrosses. Albatrosses are majestical and beautiful, but they are...
And mythical.
And mythical, exactly. But the small birds are just as amazing.
And you can, of course, see why they're mythical, why they've loomed so large in the imagination of old sailors, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. Their size, their coloration, their detail, and the way they just glide, and they come out of nowhere almost. As I said, when the trawler's winches start moving, you didn't see them, and then all of a sudden they're there. So it's just this mythical appearance out of the middle of the ocean.
Like out of the mist.
Out of the mist. Yeah, and on many occasions it is out of the mist.
Takes you back to these old ships.
Yeah.
And all they had was the creaking of the winds, of the sails and the wood. And
that slow lapping of the water against the boat.
So time in your life that you're very grateful to have had.
Very much so. I can say, even in my interview, they asked me how long I would stay in the job. And I still said to them, in hindsight, probably not the best thing. I'm going to be here for a year to gain experience. And I was out at sea for over 10 years.
Really? I didn't realize that.
Yes. Yeah, I did over probably 70 trips out at sea. So you do, you become friends with these fishermen, these guys. I still occasionally see some of them when I'm back in Cape Town, just passing in the shops. It's a part of your life I miss. And yeah, just the general experience. It's just something you can't really explain.
Quite some life she's leading is our Bronwyn Marie. She couldn't possibly be further from the South Seas in her current job, which is as curator of the Biodiversity Centre at Lapalala Wilderness School in the Waterberg. Bronwyn, thank you so much for your great kindness towards me and my dogs during our visit here. Here on Clive Walker's farm live a couple in a caravan. They are Rian and Janet van Sale, and they've been so kind to us during our stay here. Their camp is as neat as the proverbial, but I immediately noticed that they hadn't been here long. So what brought them?
About 2.5 years ago, I was diagnosed with cancer. I started the treatment, and the treatment affected me quite severely. I had to make a decision to give up a secure job and income for exchange of my health, to have a more quiet lifestyle, or more peaceful lifestyle with less stress. Spoke to my wife and we made a decision. We decided to sell the house and everything. We opted for living in a caravan. I said to Janet, my wife, you know, we're not sure what the future holds. I have to get through this thing. Let's
The future of your health.
Yeah, the health and life in general. Of course, I had to give up a secure job. I was in the position to apply for early retirement. But yeah, I still need to continue working. And not being sure where we were going to end up, we said, let's get a caravan and yeah, live in a caravan. Then we mobile. So if there's opportunities arising, then at least we can fairly easily pack up and go. And yeah, that's what we did.
Was it hard to divest yourself of everything in your house?
It was, strangely enough, more for me than for Janet, because I'm quite sentimental. And I never thought, you know, I was that attached to earthly things. And I actually found that it was not that easy. And, you know, again, what do you give up? You've got the whole house. You've got a garage full of tools and equipment and all kinds of stuff. Now you have to downscale to living in a caravan. But yeah, once you start getting rid of stuff, it gets easier and easier, and you are forced to think what is the bare basics you need. And with what you keep, will you be able to improvise and using that? So it was quite an interesting, but also a big exercise. You know, I stood for Saturdays at end, deciding this must go or that must be, can we keep this or should we keep this?
And Janet was saying, no. No?
No, for her it was easy. She just said, let it go, let it go.
So what do you miss now when you look back? What do you miss?
I would say some of my tools. Even though I'm not, you know, that much of a handyman, but I mean, I can do the basics. But, you know, I had to let go of a good couple of tools. But, you know, you have to improvise and it forces you to make plans. Or then to be patient up until you can get to someone that's got something and you can. So that's the other thing. You know, I'm not a very patient person. If I want something to be done, it must be now. So you learn, you're forced to take a deep breath and apply a bit of patience.
And can you feel yourself sort of decompressing to the point where this is having a positive effect on your health?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. This is the best thing we could have done, honestly. I was working in a very stressful environment and a lot of pressure. And 2 weeks after I went on early retirement, Janet already said to me, you're a different person. And various other people said that to me. But, you know, I can honestly say that last year I finished the treatments and stuff and I feel like a new person. So I'm very fortunate to have a wife that's willing to live this lifestyle. Because you see, there's a difference. A lot of people do this when they retire, but they still have their house. They rent it out and they put all their furniture in storage. We got rid of everything. We don't have a house. There's not a plan B. There's only a plan caravan.
Yeah, I'm the same. I think I've scaled down, but actually I do have a home to go to
yeah.
if things get rough or too cold. You know,
yeah.
You really, it's the cold or the heat that will drive you home for a while. Yeah. So you're now settled for a while on Clive Walker's property.
Yeah.
Fortunately for me, because you've helped me with so much.
Yeah.
But what interests me is the education that you're doing for kids about small mammals. Tell me about that.
Well, it started a couple of years back. I was involved with the mine where I was working there, the Environmental Education Center. And we did a complete weekend program with school children. And I wanted to do something with a live animal with them. But, I mean, you can't go and catch an impala or something. So from my work in conservation, I had a colleague that is a small mammal specialist, Christia Newberry, and I spoke to her and I said, Christia, help me, give me training. I want to catch mice, show them to the children and teach them about it. Of course, I knew by then that, you know, the importance of small mammal in the ecology. So yeah, long story short, Christia came out about twice and she gave me some equipment and taught me how to catch the animals and, you know, how to handle them. So I worked that into the weekend program we did. And then when we moved here to Vaalwater area, last year, I thought maybe I must try a small mammal safari. And then focusing on lodges, because there's a lot of lodges in the area. And I presented the idea to one of the local lodges in the area. And they said, yes, let's give it a go. So what I do is, it's actually over 2 days. The first afternoon, I then do a presentation with the children, telling them about small mammals, their role and importance in the ecology and so on. And then we go and put out the traps and I get them involved. They put the bait in the traps. I teach them how to set up the traps. We do the transects in the veld, in the bush. They put out the traps. We mark the traps with a piece of barrier tape so that we don't miss them. And then the next morning early, we go out again. We go and check the traps. So they really, really, really enjoy it.
I bet that's like an Easter egg hunt, isn't it?
Very much, yeah.
It's love, yeah. See, I've got one.
Yeah, I mean, they are so excited. They ran ahead of me because they now know where the transits are and where we've put them. So I laugh because, you know, when they get to a trap and the door is open, it's like, oh, no, oh. And then when they get to one that's closed, the door, then there's huge excitement. They jump up and down and shout, and yes, we've got one.
And then they're fed into plastic bags, and then you can show them about the mouse, who it is, what it is, how it lives, yeah?
Yeah, so what I do, we obviously can't handle the mice with your hands, and they will bite you. So we shake them out in a thick, see-through or clear plastic bag. And then I put them in a fish tank so they can see them nicely. But then we go one step further. Christia, the small mammal specialist that I told you about, she actually written the first key to identify small mammals on external characteristics. So I guide them through the key, but they have to identify it. So step by step, you know, look at the size and the length of the tail and the color and all the different characteristics that she's shown in the key. And they enjoy it. Yeah, and
they do. And why are things like dassies and squirrels not included as small mammals?
Well, they are theoretically small mammals. But in this instance, we're just looking at the mice, as I said, mice, shrews. I
mean, easier to get hold of as well.
Definitely. It's not that easy to catch a dassie or any of the other bigger small mammals.
Yeah.
So the traps that we use are, you know, lend themselves for these animals to go in easily. The bait is easy to make and to use. The other animals, I mean, you've said it, definitely more difficult to catch them. These are easy, fairly easy to catch and to release them again.
I'm thinking what a perfect way it is of entertaining kids when their folks are having a holiday in a lodge.
Absolutely.
I mean, this is a no-brainer. Why are you not, well, people like you. Why aren't you doing this all over the show?
Yeah, just a comment on that. Firstly, where we did these first safaris, one of the comments that definitely came back from the owner of the property is that the parents said to them, thank you, we can we can get rid of the children for 3 hours in the afternoon and 3 in the morning. So that definitely is a factor.
It's a factor, yeah.
And, but yeah, I'm honestly thinking of marketing that going forward. Parents come to the bush for the weekend, they stay in the lodge, and I'll take the children on a
And they learn safari. And I'm sure that in many cases their attitude towards mice is completely transformed, isn't it?
I would like to believe that, definitely. People in general, and obviously the children as well, don't know about small mammals, about mice. Our reference to them is ratteks and maybe your engine wires that's been chewed up. And then, you know, people just want to kill them. But yet they play such an important role in the ecology. And people don't know it.
Just in a little synopsis, what sort of function do they have in our whole ecology?
Unfortunately, their most important role is being food for other animals. And so a lot of animals in nature are dependent on mice as a food source for them. But apart from that, they dig holes. They stay underground or in the ground, or a lot of the species. So they make tunnels like moles. By doing that, they aerate the soil, providing oxygen for the other ground living organisms and the roots for plants. They enrich the soil by living underground. You know, they defecate and urinate and put nutrients back into the soil. They create habitat by making these holes for lizards and insects and other small animals. They pollinate plant species. They eat plants and seeds, and then also disperse the seeds. They also carry and spread parasites like ticks, even though we don't like ticks, but they play a very important role in nature by spreading diseases and in that way control animal populations.
Gosh, you don't think about that. Mice as vectors of ticks and therefore diseases to keep populations, animal populations down. Interesting. Rian van Sail, who does small mammal safaris, and I hope his business does well. If you're interested, just text us, contact us, email us, and I'll pass your inquiries on to him because he's building his business. And our last story of this series comes from Tom Nevin, a fellow traveler who hit the road, as many do, as a way of trying to unscramble himself. Tom has worked in several industries, among them hospitality in East Africa. He loves his motorbike and he loves Africa. So when his marriage came to an end, it was an easy decision to hit the road.
That was one of the main reasons. Going through the divorce, had just come to its end, and I needed to spend time on my own trying to find out, and what are the words?
Discover yourself.
Well, you know, I don't want to use that cliche.
No, please don't. Please don't.
Because I hate that, you know, discover. Have you not, you're 60 years old, have you not yet discovered who
yourself.
You are? You know. So I think maybe more just to go and spend time on my own. I'd been with people and people and people. And I was at that stage in my life where, and point in my life that I wanted to just go and be on my own and find interesting things to do.
Why, though, did you think that traveling, and particularly on your bike, would be what you would find most emotionally and psychologically useful?
Okay, so the bike was the only transport that I had at the time. And I'd been watching some videos of other travelers that had their bike and, you know, they packed their things on the bike and off they went. And it looked appealing. It looked very appealing. Once you get onto the bike and you have all your things, it's actually quite difficult, and one
what,
has to be very selective.
The weight,
and then you're very restricted to what you can actually take with you, because you have your clothes that need to go, you have all your camera equipment that has to be there, you have a tent, there's so it it fills up very, very quickly. But I managed to get pretty much everything on that I needed. I wasn't sure where I was going to go. I hadn't even decided. So literally the night before I left, my bike was packed. I took a map of South Africa and closed my eyes, pointed my finger, and landed on Tabazimbi. And then that's where I went the next day.
Which is just about in Botswana. You may have been starting your journey in another country. Okay, we'll get to your travel routes, etc. in a minute. But, I mean, I thought I'd gone minimalist. I have not at all by comparison with people like you. And did you find it liberating to have so little?
I did. You know, that cliche, out on the open road and feeling the freedom and the wind through your hair. Okay, you've got a helmet on, so you don't really feel the wind through your hair, but it was liberating. I did feel a sense of release and, you know, something new, something exciting is lying ahead and waiting for me.
And you use a drone and you shoot yourself traveling. I would think if you see your drone footage at the end of the day, you're even more aware of how freeing this experience is.
Absolutely. No, it was difficult filming with the drone, and it was difficult filming everything yourself and time-consuming. You know, one doesn't realize how time-consuming, because if you want one shot where you're approaching on the bike on the road, you have to first get to that place, set the camera up on the tripod, switch the camera on, go back to a point where it's going to make sense, and then come past the camera, then turn around, go back, switch the camera off, pack everything back up, and continue. So, you know, a shot like that can take, you know, half an hour setting it up.
And the reason for this is because you had, like me, a need to convey what was happening to you. With me, it's through audio, through podcasts, although I'm having to develop some sort of acuity in the visual aspect. But I, for some reason, I want to tell people about this. And clearly you did too.
I did. I wanted to document my journey. I wanted to document mainly the people that I would meet along the way, because it was more about their stories than my story. It was about finding, like you, you know, the story catcher. It was one of the tricks was to find the interesting stories and to find the interesting people.
And again, like me, or me like you, the people are infinitely better as a reason to travel than the sites. Yeah.
Yes, that is what I found. I've traveled quite extensively through Europe and through Africa. I've seen a lot of countries, and it's more about the people and their stories to get a feel of places rather than just going to see the attractions in those areas.
So the finger landed on Tabazimbi. Mm. And then what happened?
I didn't know a soul in Tabazimbi. I arrived in Tabazimbi in the late afternoon. I found a guest house. I unpacked my things, and then I thought, you know, now I need to try and find some people. Still got some time in the day. And I went to the local co-op because I thought the co-op is a gathering place for a lot of people go there.
Damn good idea. I had never thought of it. You know, everybody says go to the local pub.
But the co-op,
what a great idea. And it worked.
It worked. Within 5 minutes, the chap behind the counter said to me that he has to phone his auntie, who is the mayor of Tabazimbi. And the next day I had an interview with her. And that's where it kind of all started.
Wow. Then you know everyone. You know the mayor. You got contact, yeah. Bedornered.
Yeah, and then you have to meet Nicolette. And then once I met Nicolette, she said, oh, you have to meet Ken. And then so it snowballed from there.
But is it not so that the mayor set you up with accommodation? So from night two, you were living like a royal.
So the mayor set me up with Nicolette, and I said to her that I had so much editing to do. You know, I have to sit for a few days. And she said, "Where are you staying?" I said, at a local guest house. She said, "What do you need?" I said, "Well, really, I only need, you know, electricity for my laptop." She said, "Oh, no, they have a game farm 20 kilometers outside Tabazimbi. The farmhouse is standing empty. Would I like to go and stay there?" So I'd met her in the morning, and in the afternoon she was giving me the keys to her game farm to go and stay. And I stayed for 3 months
in
the farmhouse. And I just found stories, and I traveled from there. So I had a base, which I hadn't planned on, but it was actually worked out very, very well.
And then when you moved on, where did you move to? Or did you use a finger fall?
No. From there, it was all, you need to meet so-and-so, and you need to meet so-and-so, and then so, and then from there, it went along. The journey progressed. They asked me if I could do the photography for the Marikele Marathon. And it was in 2022. And there I met Ken Maud. And Ken was the chairman of the Tourism Association for the Waterberg. And he said, "You must come to Vaalwater because there's a lovely story there." And then Ken said, "I must meet Alan Van Coller, who is a buffalo breeder here." And they were looking for somebody to come and help them manage. They had 10 lodges on Lindani, which they weren't coping with the buffalo business and hospitality. So with my background in hospitality, he thought that I could maybe come and help them, and been here ever since.
So the journey, the bike journey, was not in kilometers. It wasn't very long,
but it was very short.
And did you feel then that you had sorted out your head?
I did. When I arrived at Lindani with Alan and Denise and his mum and dad, Sam and Peggy, I felt at peace. And I just knew that these are fabulous people, down to earth, no BS, and I felt comfortable. And then I stayed. But I was disappointed. I envisaged my journey to take me, you know, into Russia and Siberia and traveling South America. And I got as far as Tabazimbi. And that was the end of my journey on the road.
But journeys must provide whatever they do. You must not impose, the way I see it. You mustn't impose on them what you think you need from them. It will decide.
The journey is not as how long the journey is, isn't it? That's another cliche. It's about who you meet and what happens to you along the way, even if that journey is going to be a very short one.
So have you sold the bike, or do you still yearn to hit the road at some
time? I've still got the bike. I still use it around Lindani. And it's waiting. I've still got all my things. The camera, I do freelance media work, photography and video, promotional videos still. So that also, you know, keeps me out of mischief. But the bike is there and waiting. And I think at some stage I may, you know, venture out again.
Well, let's not tell the Lindani folk that.
No.
Tom Nevin, whose journey took him to precisely where he needed to be, as all journeys do, if we let them. In fact, even if we don't let them. The road rules, in my experience. It rules without any mind to where we think we want to go and how and what time and with whom. It just rules. Trying to just let it rule is very hard, I find. I still lack the flexibility and acceptance that would make me a happier roadie. Maybe I'll get there. A couple of days ago, Tom took me to the place where his very short road took him. It's a small game reserve called Lindani, and it is just gorgeous. One of the most beautiful pieces of bush I've seen, with all the dramatic outlooks that the Waterberg is famous for. And it's aimed at people just like me and you, who want peace and privacy and places to walk and cycle. Oh, and who want their dogs with them. I think I've counted only 3 self-catering places around here that are pet-friendly, and no campsites. Hope that changes soon. I have been greeted and treated with such warmth here, so thank you, Waterbergers, for doing so much to make us feel welcome. Thank you especially to Clive Walker for giving us a spot on his farm to camp, Rian and Janet Fonsale, who were such neighbourly neighbours here, and Richard Wadley, who made such an effort to find interesting folk for me to chat to. And then he missed all the fun due to an accident in his Land Rover, or rather with his Land Rover. It's quite a story. And maybe he'll tell it when next we come here. Storycatcher will be taking a sabbatical now for a few months while I overhaul Alexandra and the project and my life. But I'll be watching and waiting for your stories, so please keep them coming. Thanks for joining us for the ride. It's been 9 months of big scary on a big roller coaster, and my smallest of small team has done the work of 100 brave souls. Our newcomer, Hayley Light, will be helping us with social media in the future. Sorry we stopped as soon as you started, Hayley. Please don't take it personally. Thank you, Amy Moss, aka Amy Bombom, the most cheerful, patient, and encouraging person I could possibly have asked for in an editor. She has every right to laugh or scream at my lack of tech skills, but somehow she managed to control herself. Well, at least when I was within earshot. Couldn't do it without you, kid. Truly. And to David Lamkin, aka Maestro, thank you for guiding the Storycatcher project so deftly and in so many ways, artistic, editorial, videographic, among them. You deserve a 6-week holiday on Lamu. I'm sorry that all I can afford is some vino pinco plonco. Maybe after the next season. David has written a guest blog for us, which is up on my blog page. It's all about his memories of the Waterberg and the associations it still carries for him. Yummy stuff. Take a look. And so, till that next season, all the best from Patricia Glynn.